Columbia Boulevard. And the other one, I didn't get the date at Mount Tabor.
Oh, sorry, December 8th. I believe
December
that's a
8th, and that
Thursday.
is that also 3 p.m.?
Yes, sir.
December 8th, Thursday, 3 p.m. at 6437 Southeast Division. And that wraps it up for this evening's show. We've been listening to James O'Loughlin of City Workers Laborers Local 483, ready to strike. And thanks to my co-host Laura Wadlin. I'm Jamie Partridge. This is Labor Radio this Monday and every Monday at 6 p.m. Stay tuned for Prison Pipeline.
This is Rocker T passing through, you know, when I'm in Portland. Checking for 90.7 cable, for real. This is the One Love Jam down with a DJ like Ja Will, for real. Now my selector!
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Good evening. You're listening to Prison Pipeline here on KBOO Community Radio. Tonight we are talking with Hillary Nichols from the OHSU Richmond Clinic. And we're also talking with Joshua Edward Wright, the Executive Director of the Exiled Voice. We're talking tonight about the issue of connecting on Medicaid access for incarcerated people. Hillary, welcome to Prison Pipeline.
My name is Hillary Mari Lopez Nichols. Some things about me: I'm a queer person, I'm a mother of a one-year-old child, and I work at the OHSU Richmond Clinic as the health equity community organizer. And I never really saw myself working in healthcare, but I used to work in the city of Seattle, in the city government, and there were so many things that bothered me about kind of what I saw and who I saw represented in government and how decisions were being made without community input. And it really lit a fire in me about myself and helping other people, supporting other people in being engaged in particularly their local governments, but generally in public policy. So I have a really special opportunity to do community organizing through the Richmond Clinic, which really started because we know that the social determinants of health have way bigger influence on your overall health than the amount of doctor's visits you're able to go to, or even your medications. And so really, when you're talking about the social determinants of health, you also have to think about the structural determinants of health, and that happens to be like laws and policies and things like that. So I came to the Richmond Clinic about 2 years ago, and a big part of my job is that I talk to people who come to the Richmond Clinic as patients. At the Richmond Clinic, we have a group called HEALER, which is Health Equity and Leadership at Richmond. And that is a group of people who care about health justice. And some of us are patients some of us work in healthcare, but many of us don't. And we organize together for health justice.
So Joshua, welcome to Prison Pipeline. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your story and why you're here today?
Yeah, definitely. I'm Joshua Edward Wright, and they, them pronouns is preferred. I practice relationship anarchy in my personal life, but I'm really here because I was in prison for a little bit over 4 years, And I was born with a terminal genetic illness called cystic fibrosis. And there was a lot of overlap in my sentence with interacting with the medical community there and the staff, and just trying to advocate for myself to receive the treatments and the medications that I needed in order to survive. And Healer, we were focused a lot on that kind of overlap between imprisonment and, you know, receiving healthcare and trying to thrive and survive in that type of environment, as well as all the difficulties coming out. And so, yeah, I really appreciate that. I work with Liberation Literacy. I co-founded that when I was in prison. I started the first gender and sexuality class in the Oregon Department of Corrections while I was doing time. And I started a podcast after release called The Exiled Voice that I'm still working on and with. But yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, Joshua. It's a real pleasure having you both on. So one thing that a lot of people don't know is that when someone is booked into, say, for instance, Multnomah County Jail, where people are often held for months on end without actually having hearings, their Medicaid is suspended. What happens to their lives? What happens to their health care when their Medicaid is suspended? And what happens if they're released? Say they've been booked, but they never get charged.
You want to take that one first, Joshua, and then I'll fill in.
Yeah, definitely. One of the biggest problems with that is if you are booked and released, let's say you go in for a weekend or you go in for a week or you get charged with a misdemeanor and you serve a month. If you get something like Social Security disability or supplemental security income through the Social Security Administration, or even have, you know, Oregon health plan or some type of state insurance, that automatically is taken away. And you have to usually reapply depending on how much time goes by. If you get sentenced to prison, you always have to reapply. And it's a real struggle to get both health insurance, but in particular, like disability determination again. A lot of people understand how hard it is to get that first disability approval income in the first place. And that just kind of adds to that level of stress when you get out trying to reacclimate to society, trying to get a job, trying to get housing. There's this huge burden that if you can't get a job, if you are disabled or you struggle mentally, or you know, you used to have these services that you could rely on for income or rent, or just to pay your bills, you have to go through that entire process again, which adds to the burden of, you know, coming back into society with all these extra levels, like seeing your parole officer and checking in different places and taking classes and attending things and paying bills and court fees and all that other stuff. It's an insurmountable cost that we should really address.
Hillary, when you began working at the OHSU Richmond Clinic, did you know about this issue? Was this something that you were aware of, or did you learn about this?
Yeah, thank you for that question, because I think I'm in the same boat as a lot of people. I learned about this issue when I first started organizing at Richmond. I feel like I had a political alignment towards criminal justice reform and things like that broadly, but I really was naive to the extent of the injustices that happen in the carceral system. And the suspension of your Medicaid was one of the like biggest eye-opening experiences for me in like really truly starting to understand better the extent of the injustices that are involved here. What felt so tragic and ironic was that, you know, as I'm talking to different people who are our patients, I'm hearing people talk about the experiences that led to their incarceration, it's so often dealt with health issues like substance use disorder or mental health issues. And then, so to hear about people's insurance getting it suspended when they're often incarcerated for health issues in the first place felt just really wrong. And so that's something that I learned through this process. It's been people like Joshua, and getting to build relationships with people like Joshua, that I have, my heart's been completely transformed. And this is an issue that I personally really care about.
Thank you. Joshua, what are some of the ways that people, especially people with pre-existing conditions, suffer when they have their Medicaid suspended?
In particular, just the aspect, for example, someone who's diabetic that gets booked or gets arrested or spends a month or a few days in jail, even goes to prison, that aspect of getting out and trying to get insurance, in particular, like if you need insulin to eat, you have to wait until things are approved in order to cover the cost of insulin in order to like consume food, and everyone needs to eat. You know, you go 3 days without eating, you're close to like not surviving. And so, and understanding how long that process takes, it takes longer than 3 days. It takes longer than a week. It takes, you know, close to about a month on average just to reinstate certain things. And so that's a huge component of what happens is if you have a legitimate health condition, I have cystic fibrosis, I need to do breathing treatments, and I also take pills to eat. You know, days without medication, I start to cough a lot more. I start to not being able to process food. I start to not being be able to eat, and things like that that make survival, let alone anything else, nearly impossible. And so, yeah, just that difficulty of trying to get something that you know you need, but you have to basically have an institution understand why you need it in a very short time period, and those institutions are so big, it's hard to get gears moving that quickly. It's kind of like if you were sleepy and you had to convince someone every single time you were sleepy that you needed to sleep and why. That's kind of how it feels to constantly have to explain your condition, why you need it, what you have to call people, you have to check in places. It's such a job to be able to get just basic things, especially if they were once taken.
What do you suppose the rationale is that the county gives or the state?
How they rationalize it is when you are in custody, you are supposed to get adequate health care under the Oregon state law, the ORS codes. You are supposed to get the same standard of care in the community. And while the law is written that way, in practice, that's just not really how it works. I wasn't able to get certain medications that came out while I was in prison because I didn't get them in the community. For example, like advancements in care, there was a pill called Trikafta that came out that suppressed a lot of symptoms that I had with my cystic fibrosis, and I couldn't get it because it didn't exist when I was arrested. And things like that, where they kind of say that you are supposed to get it, so it should be fine that you receive prison health care. And anyone who's been to prison or knows about, you know, certain stories that come out of prison about the health care, about the food, know that it's just not that way. You do not receive, you know, the same standard of care in the community. You do not receive edible food most of the time. A lot of it says not safe for human consumption. There's been lawsuits and all kinds of things, class action against different organizations, one of which was the prison that I did the most time at, Columbia River Correctional Institution in North Portland. But that's how they justify it, is they say the law says you're supposed to get this, so it's fine.
What's it like trying to reapply for Medicaid when you've been released from prison? What is the bureaucratic process like for people who've lost their Medicaid access once they get released, trying to reconnect with that?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is you don't really know if you've been booked and released. You don't know what's going to happen in the future. You don't know if you're going to be found guilty at a trial. You don't know if you'll have to take a plea deal. You don't know if, you know, some other charges may be added to your sentence and other things like that that you'll have to address. And so you're kind of in this weird form of limbo where you are out and you need health care, but you don't know if you're going to go back in. And also the aspect of if you've been charged with crime or you do have a past kind of criminal history, you're going to be more heavily policed. And so even if you do like walk down the street, and in this country, if you're black, if you are of a different lean than like a white male Republican, it's really hard to just survive and walk down the street knowing that you won't be pulled over, you won't be arrested, you won't be questioned, you won't be charged with something because you were in the wrong area. And so you're just constantly worried about, you know, if I'm going to go back, if this is going to get taken again. But besides that, you have to do the normal process, like go online, you have to apply, you have to call, you have to submit your applications, you have to fill out tons of paperwork, which means you also have to usually find a printer or have Wi-Fi access. And if, like you said, if you're homeless, you don't have access to either one of those. You can go to a library, but then you have to figure out how to get to that library, how to get a, you know, out of that library, how to get a pen, how to fill out these forms and how to submit them, which takes time and it takes a lot of work and it takes research that you can't really do when you're trying to survive. So there's just so many aspects that come together to make it so hard to apply for something like that. And I think that's another thing we should do as a country, is address how difficult it is to receive or be eligible for disability, for health insurance, for whatever. It should be kind of provided in, you know, a few brief questions, maybe like 10 questions. Like, we could figure that out, and someone could call that person and determine if they're eligible, rather than have them fill out a 10-page, you know, form of paperwork. And so, yeah, I think that those are the main things that it make it really difficult.
So you had asked earlier about, you know, why Medicaid is suspended when somebody becomes incarcerated. And the reasons, in addition to what Joshua mentioned, is also that it's written into the Social Security Act. So that is just structurally how it's meant to go. So there are a couple of bills in the House, in the Senate right now. In the House, it's H.R. 955. And in the Senate, it is S-285. They're both called the Medicaid Reentry Act of 2021, and they would simply change that part of the Social Security Act to allow, in their words, inmates to be covered 30 days pre-release rather than post-release as it is right now. There's also some decisions that the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, otherwise known as CMS, can make by the end of the year that don't have to do with legislation actually, but rather something called an 1115 waiver, which is essentially this big document that the Oregon Health Authority and other state health authorities send to the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services every 3 to 5 years, which essentially in 600 pages or less, asks the federal government, you know, this is how we want to use our Medicaid money, and these are some of the new things that we'd like to try with Medicaid, but we need your approval and maybe bending some of the rules to be able to do that. So Oregon Health Authority, in, you know, an attempt to really center health equity for imprisoned people, included parts of in their 1115 waiver that have to do with Medicaid coverage for people who are incarcerated, including full Oregon Health Plan coverage for all incarcerated youth, full OHP benefits for people in jail, and then 90 days pre-release for people coming out of a prison or a psychiatric facility or Oregon State Hospital, which would be huge. But CMS hasn't approved those pieces of the waiver yet, for multiple different reasons. So it's those two. It's the Medicaid Reentry Act of 2021, and it's the decision that the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services can make regarding the 1115 waivers that states have put forward that have asked for the rules to change so that Medicaid coverage can happen before release.
So, Hillary, what would people need to do if they wanted to show support for this kind of an issue? Is this something where people would need to call? First of all, where do our representatives stand on this? Like Earl Blumenauer, Jeff Merkley, have you heard anything back from those offices? Where they stand on this? Is this something they have a voice on?
Yes, unfortunately, those two representatives are very much for these bills to move through. So in terms of what people can do, I mean, find who your representative is, particularly, you know, in your district, and encourage them to support this, ask them to leverage their power. That's something that we can all do as community members and citizens. And if you're interested in getting more in-depth, knowledge about ways that you can make a difference, folks who are interested in learning more about this and connecting with people like myself and Joshua and other people who really care about this issue and are trying to push our push health equity forward, can contact me. Again, my name is Hillary. My email is nicholhi@ohsu.edu. And my phone number is 503-720-8643. You can text that number if you want. And we're really just looking to get connected with people who want to see movement on this issue and other health equity issues, particularly that affects imprisoned people.
Thank you. Joshua, what in addition to the things Hillary said, can people do to help change this?
I think the biggest thing is interacting with people who have done time, learning more about their stories, advocating for that, watching documentaries, for example, like things like 13th on Netflix, reading books, read examples of things that have happened in the American prison system, like Blood in the Water by Heather Ann Thompson, a book about the Attica Rebellion, things like that, where you're always trying to educate yourself and you're always trying to advocate for others, and you're always trying to connect. And I think those are the biggest things that do a lot of help for people like me is seeing us as human and breaking down the conditioned barriers that are associated with us, like the monstrosity, the violence, the chaotic nature of how we're portrayed usually in the media. I think that's a big way of doing that, just connecting and hearing our stories.
Thanks. And with your own personal work, Joshua, you mentioned a couple of things you do that people can learn more about. Can you talk about those again?
Yeah, definitely. And that's so I co-founded Liberation Literacy when I was doing time with an outside prison volunteer named Dr. Garrett Felber, and that's still going pretty strong. We have a partnership with Reed College, and we have a reentry resource desk in North Portland at a place called Open House. It's a co-working collective space, and people can come in 2 days a week and just get help with what they need, help them find food stamps, help them, just look for services. We help them look online. We help them, fill out applications. We help them email places, just get some resources if they need that. Secondarily, my podcast, The Exiled Voice, that I'm the director of and created and still run, is a podcast where I interview other people who've done time, and we just talk about our stories and what we endured and what we're focused on now, and that's at theexiledvoice.com. And just go to those pages and support them, listen to them, check in with Liberation Literacy. We have events, community events occasionally, maybe like once a month, once every few weeks now. And if you want to reach out to me personally, if you want to be on my podcast or anything like that, or just listen to more of my story, you can do the same thing as Hillary. I'm on Facebook at Joshua Edward Wright, and my email is jeb91588@yahoo.com. You can reach out about anything.
Thanks. So I'd like to return to the topic of the show today for the last few minutes. Hillary, what are the names of those bills that people can write about if they'd like to address correcting these gaps and this lack of coverage for former adults in custody, people who are, pre-conviction or post-release, who need to get their Medicaid? What are those bills again that people can write about?
Yes, they are called the Medicaid Reentry Act of 2021. And if you search that up on Google, it should come up, but the bill numbers are HR 955 and S285.
Yeah, definitely. I think that it's always really important to contact your legislator. I think that's something that will help a lot in getting things moved forward. The bills that Hillary brought up, the House bill and the Senate bill, I think both are really important to advocate for, really important to contact your legislator, really important to share that you agree with these things. And of course, do your own research, look into them. But I would love for people to just support those bills and try to get them passed and try to get our representatives to understand that those are important for us.
So I'm wondering, Josh, in the last couple of minutes we have on the show, have you heard of anyone who, I mean, it sounds like this is really critical to your care, and just your condition you mentioned is something that would really be a problem if you weren't able to get appropriate medical treatment for it. You brought up an example of a person who has diabetes. Do you know of anyone who is in the system who wasn't able to get care once they were released and, you know, suffered as a result of that?
Yeah, absolutely. In particular, one of my close friends, Gus, he had been arrested for murder the year I was born, in 1988. And for what's called a crime of passion, he shot someone that his wife had been having an affair with, and he was, you know, found guilty of murder and sentenced to prison. He was pretty old, and, you know, he kind of had a very strict routine. He just went back and forth to the yard. He worked out a little bit. You know, he went to the chow hall to eat. He went back and he just rested in his bed. He had a stroke, I think my second or third year of prison. And it was in the middle of the night. And so at Columbia River Correctional Institution, the medical staff goes home around 9 or 10 p.m. And it is up to the correctional officers to call for medical assistance if that is needed after hours. And he had a stroke, may have been a heart attack, I can't remember which, but either way, he was on the floor of our dorm, of our unit. We lived in dorms of 80 people. And we went and tried to get the officer, a woman, I won't name her, because I think I can't, but to try to call someone to get help for him, and it was hours. We eventually had to like round up like 10 of us and go to her office and say, hey, if you don't call, like something bad will happen. And like trying to use aggression in a positive way, because she just refused to do anything about it. And by the time that she did call after that and the firefighters and EMTs came, he was already dead from this heart attack or stroke. And they even said offhandedly, like, hey, well, why didn't you call us sooner? We might have been able to do something. Like, we heard comments because it's a dorm setting. They were talking to this officer in her office, and you know, things like that are not rare in prison. They are not common, but they are not rare. And you know, for me in particular, I was also denied the pills I needed to eat on two separate occasions, because I had to get them to understand that I need to take them when I eat, not before, not after. They're supposed to be digested with meals. And so they refused to give me food to eat. That's like a medical starvation. They kept saying that I was refusing food by not taking my pills at times when they wouldn't be effective. And that type of thing is pretty common, very common, actually, like denial of medication for arbitrary reasons, you know, requirements that aren't in their rules and regulations, that they say, oh, they can't go outside the rules and regulations to give you medication if you need them in different ways. And so everyone's unique and everyone needs, you know, different things, different treatments, different medications, and they all have to be given at set times. But that's not really how it works in prison. It is at set times, and it's always uniform. And so a lot of conditions that are different or rare or, you know, need more care get pushed to the side or get dismissed or get disregarded, and people are affected greatly by that. And me, I was in particular, and my friend Gus died because of that.
We've been talking today with Hillary Nichols and with Joshua Edward Wright. We've been talking about the issue of healthcare justice, and there are some policy decisions that the federal government could make by the end of 2022 that would allow rules for inmates to be covered by Medicaid prior to release. And this would be a huge step forward for healthcare justice. The Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services is the agency that provides these pre-release waivers, and we're just talking today here on Prison Pipeline about this issue of this gap that happens for people who have been incarcerated, even booked into jail and released without being charged and losing their Medicaid coverage. So thank you so much, Hillary and Joshua, for joining us tonight on Prison Pipeline.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be
listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and